song leading this morning. It's good to see everyone. I want to take just a moment, if I may, and express a word of commendation to this congregation. There have been a lot of folks recently among us who have gone through some difficult times, and this congregation always responds, and always responds above and beyond. But may I just say to you that especially in the last couple of weeks, there are just so many of you who have responded in the groups and providing food or in visiting those who were sick or helping those who were ill, going to the hospital, being of comfort to families who were grieving over the loss of loved ones, seeing something that you can do. And without in any way trying to call attention to yourselves, you've done that. And it really has been overwhelming. And may I say to you how pleased I know that the Lord is at all of that that this congregation has been doing. It sure makes an honor to be a part of you. I'd like to direct your attention this morning to a passage in Romans chapter 1, verses 28 through 32. In these verses, the Apostle Paul is talking about the Gentiles and about the fact that God has every right, every judicial right, to come in wrath upon the Gentiles. And he speaks about the sins of mankind here in Romans 2, beginning with verse 28. And just as they did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer, God gave them over to a depraved mind to do those things which are not proper, being filled with all unrighteousness, wickedness, greed, evil, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, arrogant, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, without understanding, untrustworthy, unloving, unmerciful. And although they know the ordinance of God, that those who practice such things are worthy of death, they not only do the same, but also give hearty approval to those who practice them. In this set of verses, the Apostle Paul is talking about a whole host of horrendous wrongs, horrendous sins that we as human beings can commit. But may I say to you this morning, when you look closely at what Paul says, especially in verse 32, what you see is that we don't have to actually engage in those sinful practices that other people are engaging in to be guilty of sin ourselves. What Paul indicates here is that we sin when we approve of sinners and the sinful things that they are engaging in. Again, verse 32, although they know the ordinance of God that those who practice such things are worthy of death, they not only do the same, but also give hearty approval to those who practice them. What that says to me is you don't have to actually engage in a particular sin to be guilty. It may be that there are others who are engaging in that sin, and you, by your words or by your deeds, may be showing an approval of the things that they are doing, and as far as God is concerned, you're guilty too. And that's the very point Paul makes here in this verse. I want to talk to you this morning about this question. How can we show an approval of sinners? If we understand the import of what Paul is saying and that God holds us accountable, even if we have not engaged in sinful things, if we are showing an approval of those who do engage in those things, then it begs the question, well, how is it that we can show approval? And I want to say to you, first of all, that one way in which we show approval of those who are sinning is by helping them in committing the sinful things that they are doing. assisting people who are doing things that are wrong. In Acts chapter 22 and verse 20, the apostle Paul here is looking back about his former life before he was a Christian, and in particular talking about that incident when he assisted in that execution of Stephen, that unjust execution of Stephen. He says, "And when the blood of your witness Stephen was being shed, I also was standing by approving and watching out for the coats of those who were slaying him." Did Paul pick up a stone and cast it at Stephen? Was he personally guilty of murdering that righteous servant of God? No. But he stood by and kept those coats of those who were engaging in that practice, who were doing the actual act of murder. He assisted them in that because Paul had not actually taken up a stone and cast it at that first Christian martyr. Was he guiltless? Because what we see in this is that he was showing his approval of what they were doing by his actions that really were assisting them, facilitating them in the very sinful thing that they were engaging in on that occasion. We need to understand that we can be guilty of sin ourselves by assisting others who are doing wrong things. In fact, this is the very thing that John is talking about in 2 John, verses 10 and 11. As he's talking about false teachers who would be traveling to their area and teaching a doctrine that was very clearly, very unabashedly, not in accordance with what the apostles had been teaching. And John says this, "If anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not receive him into your house. And do not give him a greeting, for the one who gives him a greeting participates in his evil deeds." What are you talking about, John? Well, he's talking about those who would be coming in and seeking lodging in that city where they want to teach their doctrine that is, by even their own admission, not what the apostles of Jesus were teaching. And so they want someone who was there, someone who was a Christian there, to provide them lodging. And here John says, if you do that, if you provide them lodging in your house, or he may even be talking about the house where they are worshiping, and you provide them that access, you're not guilty of actually teaching the false teaching with your own mouth, but you are guilty of participating with them in that sin. You're facilitating them. You're assisting them. He even goes so far as to say, if with your mouth you give them a Christian greeting, which would be something like, may the Lord be with you, or that kind of thing, that would be endorsing them, and yet you know that this is the kind of false teaching that they're engaging in when they're in your area. John says, you're participating with them in that evil deed. But I didn't teach the false doctrine, but you helped that person who was doing it. And you knew that's what was going on. So what this is hopefully beginning to help us see is that the bar needs to be raised higher than we sometimes want to raise it. It isn't just an issue of me making sure that I don't engage in something sinful, that I don't engage in some sinful practice or some wrong behavior. It also is incumbent upon me to make sure that I don't assist somebody else who would be engaging. Now, in the case of Saul, he absolutely wanted people to know that he was approving of what was going on in Stephen's martyrdom. But what John's talking about here are Christians who were not really wanting to say that they were endorsing these false teachers, but John says, that's really what you're doing. Whether you intend to be doing that or not, when you give them lodging, when you give them that greeting, when you verbally indicate that they, at least supposedly, are right with God, you are tacitly endorsing them and therefore having fellowship, participating with them in their evil deeds. And so we need to think about this. We can show an approval of sinful people by facilitating them in their sin. You know, in our judicial system, we even have a term for this. We call it aiding and abetting the criminal. You're not guilty of the crime itself, but you aided and abetted them. And that's really what we're seeing in this. That's one way that you can show your approval of sinners in committing their sin, and that's not something God is pleased with. How can we show approval of sinners? By telling them that they're okay as they engage in those sinful things. By verbally telling them that they're okay, that they're right with God. And this has always been a problem that God's people have had to face. In Proverbs 24, verses 24 and 25, here's what the sage says. He who says to the wicked, "You are righteous," peoples will curse him, nations will abhor him. But to those who rebuke the wicked, a good blessing will come upon them. When there's someone in our association who is engaging in sinful behavior, what they need from us, especially if we have some relationship with them, they need to be rebuked by us. They need to be corrected by us. What they sure don't need is for somebody to make them feel like they're okay. And it's always been a problem with human beings to want to say to people whom God says are really sinning, but we don't really want to tell them that, and we have a relationship with them, and we want to be their friends so much that we want to say nice words to them and kind words to them and not really say what maybe they need to hear. In fact, this is exactly what Ezekiel was talking about in Ezekiel chapter 13 and verse 10, where it talks about those false teachers and false prophets among his people. They have misled my people, speaking for the Lord. They have misled my people by saying peace when there is no peace. You know that Hebrew word shalom, peace? It's really a lot broader than just our English word peace. We might think peace is absence from war. And certainly the word shalom can mean that. It can also mean absence from calamity and difficulty. It can also mean that everything is at peace with you. Everything is right with you. To say shalom to someone, it is shalom with you. Here are people, Ezekiel says, who are saying to God's people, in their sinfulness, shalom. Everything's right with you. There's not really any calamity that you need to be concerned about. There's no judicial wrath from God that you need to be concerned about. Everything is in a state of shalom. Everything is at peace. And yet, that's not the truth. That's a falsehood. In fact, I want you to think about what he goes on to say. He says, I will tear down the wall which you plastered over with whitewash and bring it down. I won't take time to read all the verses that are really in the context here of Ezekiel 13, but I'll tell you what he's talking about. He compares the people of God with a wall that has been erected, but it's got major cracks in it. It's not stable. It's not a strong, sturdy wall. It's got cracks in it. Now, what you need to do when you have a wall in that kind of condition is do everything necessary to fix the cracks. But what some people do, Ezekiel says, is they just whitewash over the wall. They just plaster over it and plaster over all those cracks. So you can't see those cracks. They're not as readily apparent. And therefore, you leave the wall in the same dismal state of disrepair that it originally was in. And he says here, speaking for God, I will tear down the wall which you plastered over with whitewash and bring it down. You know what we tend to do sometimes with folks? People that we have association with, people that we're very often friends with, We want to just kind of plaster over their sin. Not correct the sin, not help them correct the sin. We don't want to identify the sin. We sure don't want to rebuke them in their sin. Don't want to do that. And so what we do is we say the kind words and we say all these things that just make it seem like everything is fine with that person. Everything is at peace with them. They're right in all that they're engaging in. And we salve our conscience by thinking, well, I'm not engaging in what that person is engaging in. And after all, I'm not their judge. But God expects us, as His people, our judge expects us to point out the sin of people with whom we have that relationship, and certainly not to just let them think they're okay. And I tell you what, we need to give a lot of thought to this. Because it's real easy for us as Christians to just kind of leave all the harsh things that need to be said. Well, just leave that to the preacher. Or just leave that to the elders. Let them do all of that harsh stuff. Sometimes the most powerful correcting word that can be said to somebody who has been overcome by sin is for you, as someone close to them, as their friend, to not let them keep whitewashing over their sin anymore. But point out to them, no, things are not at peace with you. You're not being right. And the things you're engaging in, and the things that you're thinking of, and the things that you're, just the direction that you're going in, it's not right. And if we do the other, then really we're just approving. We're really showing, whether we want to admit it or not, it's okay. We're really showing a measure of approval about that. We can't make that mistake. How can we show approval of sinners? I'll give you one final way in which we can show approval of sinners. We've talked about assisting them in their sin. We've talked about telling them that they're okay. You know, another way, in fact, sometimes the most effective way, where we unwittingly show an approval of other people's sin is by simply doing nothing. Don't do anything that shows disapproval. Don't say anything that would be correcting them. Just do nothing. And that tacitly shows those people they're okay. That's the message that we send. In 1 Corinthians chapter 5, we learn that's exactly what the church at Corinth was sending as their message. To that incestuous man who was living with his father's wife, Paul writes them and says, you've done nothing about that. He says, you have become arrogant and have not mourned instead, so that the one who had done this deed would be removed from your midst. You've allowed this to just go on. And he says it is a mournful kind of thing. You should have mourned about the fact that this individual is brazenly sinning and is going to lose his soul and is then going to corrupt the rest of the congregation. You've not mourned about that, and so you've done nothing. You should already have rebuked that person, and more than that, Paul says, remove that unrepentant person from your midst. And sometimes we show a tacit approval of other people in their sin by just sitting back and doing nothing. Or think about this passage. Ezekiel chapter 3 and verse 18. Here Ezekiel once again speaking for God says, when I say to the wicked, you will surely die, and you do not warn him or speak out to warn the wicked from his wicked way, that wicked man will die in his iniquity. But his blood I will require at your hand. Those are pretty powerful words in Ezekiel. And I might just say to you that that point, almost the same verbiage, it's repeated more than once. It's repeated throughout the book of Ezekiel. It was a common theme in the oracles of this prophet of God, because those people of God, they needed it. Because here they were in a state of sin. In fact, that's why they were going into exile. That's why they were in exile. So there was sin all around them that needed to be identified, that needed to be pointed out. And so what you have God emphasizing is, when you don't warn that person, when you don't rebuke that person, when you don't seek to correct that person with whom you had that association, He says, I'm going to judge that person, but I'm also going to require it at your hand. His blood will be on your head. This is a pretty awesome concept. It is a weighty responsibility, but it's one that we dare not abdicate. But folks, this is where we have our biggest problem. I think we have a generation of people. Maybe it's societal, you know. Maybe we're so much emphasizing love. Let's make sure love, you know, that's the word that everybody loves to just pluck out of the gospel of Jesus. And that resonates with our society. We like love. We don't like rebuke and condemnation and judgment. We don't like all of that. But our society likes the love concept, though we don't really understand what that means. And we as God's people can buy into that. Let me just ask you something here. And I've talked about this before, but I'm going to say it again, because I still see this all the time. It's amazing the kind of things that you see on various Christians' Facebook pages. The kinds of ungodly statements that are made, the kinds of ungodly language that is used. And so often the point is made, well, but that's said by people who insert that on your Facebook page. And I didn't say that, but just these friends I have, well, they said that. Let me ask you a question. Why do you think they feel comfortable talking like that on your Facebook page? Because they know you say nothing about it. You do nothing about it. There's no rebuke. There's no condemnation. And by your doing nothing and by your saying nothing, you really are approving. But I'm not engaging in that. I'm not using that kind of language. I don't talk about those things. Yeah, but you show your approval by just doing nothing and letting them get away with it. Why is it that our friends and associates so often don't have any hesitancy about speaking in our presence all those ungodly things and using all that kind of language and talking in this way? Why is it that they feel so comfortable doing that? Because we don't say anything about it. We maybe don't cuss ourselves. We don't talk about those things ourselves, but we sit there and do nothing and never correct. And the reason why we don't, you know good and well why we don't. Because we just don't want to lose them as a friend. Isn't that really it? We are so worried about somebody being offended and me hurting somebody's feelings, that's more important to us than the sin in their life which is sending them to hell. It's more important to us to just not offend them. We have our priorities all messed up. And let me say this. I absolutely do not want anyone to think that what I'm talking about this morning would justify in any way somebody just attacking someone and having a holier-than-thou kind of attitude and just lambasting them and not showing any care and compassion because, well, okay, I can pat myself on the back because I'm not just sitting back and doing nothing. I'm not talking about going to that extreme either. But let me warn you about something. So often what we tend to do is we so focus in on, okay, I got to make sure I have the right setting, and I have to make sure that everything is just the right moment, and I say it in the right way so it won't be as offensive. And so we work so hard at just planning all of that and trying to create that scenario and coming up with what would be the best way and the best time to say it and all that, that we wind up never doing anything. And again, I just want to say to you that God's not proud of that. God's not pleased with that. And so I want us to think about this, and I'm going to ask us this question. Do we really care about these friends of ours? Do we really care about them? You know, James says this in James 5, verse 19, if any among you strays from the truth and one turns him back, let him know that he who turns a sinner from the error of his way will save his soul from death and will cover a multitude of sins. It's a good thing to have somebody who cares enough to confront someone in their sinfulness. That's a good thing, James says. That shows love. That shows care and concern. But when we do the things we've talked about this morning, when we really facilitate them in their sin, or when we whitewash their sin and make them feel that they're okay, or when we just put our hands behind our back, keep our mouth shut, and do nothing, we're not really showing that we love that person. We're not showing that we care. If we really cared about them, we'd warn them. We'd talk to them. We'd say, I need to talk to you about your life or the way that you're behaving or what you're planning and this and that. It isn't right. And let me help you to do the right thing. But what you're doing is not right. That's what love does. That's what real care and compassion does. So do we really care about our friends? Do we really care about Jesus? Jesus said, whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will also be ashamed of him when he comes. A lot of people in our society who are ashamed of the things that Jesus teaches. They're ashamed of it. Sure they are. They're ashamed of what Jesus teaches about divorce and about the permanency of marriage. They're ashamed of that because they don't want to take a stand for that. And they want to whitewash over the sin of people who are going against what Jesus taught on that. There are a lot of people in our society who are ashamed of the moral standard that Jesus set forth. We're ashamed. Oh, yes, we are. Because when our friends and our associates are engaging in all that, in our purview, we just go ahead and show our approval in the various ways that we've talked about this morning. And we show that we really wish Jesus had never taught those things. We're really ashamed. And Jesus said, if you're ashamed of me and you're ashamed of my words, I'm going to be ashamed of you. On that day when you need me to stand up for you before my Father and plead your case before him and say, yes, this person is one of my disciples. They were not ashamed to stand with me and stand up for the truth and to show the kind of love that I demonstrated. They were not ashamed of me. We're going to need Jesus to say that. But Jesus says, no, I'll be ashamed of you if you're ashamed of me and my words now. So I'll tell you what, folks, the bar is pretty high. And I think there are some things here that we need to really think about. It's not just a matter of not engaging in that wrong behavior yourself. you can show your approval, even unwittingly sometimes, you can show your approval by helping other people who are sinning, by making them feel that they're okay, or by sitting back and not doing anything at all. I hope we won't make that mistake. Thank you for listening to me this morning. I wonder if there's someone this morning who needs to respond to the gospel of Jesus Christ. Can we assist you in that? We'd love to help you. Whatever be your need, won't you make that known while together we stand and sing this song of encouragement. Have you been to